In the beginning, there was nothing. And it was good. In the beginning, there wasn't any space. So there was no place to put anything. And it was good. In the beginning, there wasn't any time. So nothing ever got done. Nobody cared. And then, suddenly, there was a big bang. Amazing. We had a big bang. Look what happened. Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the show. Crazy Wisdom saves the world again, and just in time. You are a fine-looking group, Homo sapiens sapiens, Homo sapien Berkleyanus, New Breed. For my first number, I'd simply like to remind you all that we are traveling together on this little rock, hurling through space at many thousands of miles an hour, and you don't even have to hold on. Ta-da! Astonishing. A cause for wonder. I wonder, and I'd like you to ask yourself, what are we doing here? Existentially speaking. Where did we come from? Where are we going? What is this all about? Ever since we humans grew these big brains, we've been asking ourselves these questions. And to answer them, we've come up with some fantastic stories. The gods and the devils and all that stuff, all the creation myths. But lately, we've started telling ourselves a brand new story based on scientific evidence. And tonight, I'd like to share a few episodes of that story with you. So let's go back to the very beginning. The scientist said there was nothing, and then there was a big bang. But some people said if there had been nothing, what bang? So, the scientists said, good question. And they went back and they finally decided there was something. There was a dot. A singularity. A point much smaller than an atom. And so it came to pass, saith the scientist. This is a new creation myth. We want to put some flourishes into it. And so it came to pass, saith the scientist, that 13.7 billion years ago today. Why not? Happy birthday to you too. 13.7 billion years ago today, that dot exploded. And out of that explosion came space. Enough space to contain an entire universe. And out of that explosion came time. Enough time for a universe to be born and grow old and die. And out of that explosion came the elementary forces and the elementary particles and the elementary elements. And they began mixing and morphing, eventually creating billions of galaxies full of billions of suns and planets and the earth and the mountains and the oceans and the forests and the buildings and the people and the animals and the bicycles, tables, shoes, chairs, you, me, everything we can know of and name. And it all came out of the explosion of a tiny dot much smaller than an atom. Now, isn't that more plausible than the idea of a God who created everything in 6 days? Take your pick. Take your pick. Here's an image for you. A trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second after the Big Bang, the universe was 6 feet in diameter. Now that's a universe you can get your mind around, you know? Take it home, put it in the corner. Now one scientist estimates the universe to be 10 billion trillion trillion cubic light years large. Sound about right? Approximately, okay. But this universe that we're living in is such a trickster. The scientists say the universe is filled with the gas helium. Does that mean my voice is an octave lower than it sounds? Could it be that none of us have ever heard our true voice? And it looks like there's a lot of stuff here, but there's hardly any stuff here at all. Because everything in this universe that we can perceive is made out of atoms. And atoms are 99.999% empty space. You take the nucleus of an atom, blow it up millions of times till it's the size of a grain of sand. The electron going around that nucleus will be the size of a dust mote, and it'll be a half a mile away. There's hardly any matter to matter. So why don't I just fall through the floor and through the earth? This is a magic act. And if your body's made of atoms, and atoms are mostly empty space, what is holding your clothes up? Not only does the emperor have no clothes, the clothes hardly have any emperor. We're like optical illusions to each other. As they say in Zen, things are not what they seem, nor are they otherwise. Now, of course, they've broken the atom down into three itty-bitty subatomic particles, quarks, leptons, and gluons. Now, I don't know exactly how it works, but I suspect that the gluons hold the quarks and the leptons together. But what I really love is antimatter. They've discovered lots of antimatter out there, and they say whenever a particle of matter meets a particle of antimatter, they annihilate each other. I think the discovery of antimatter is proof that whoever, whatever created the universe was somewhat ambivalent. Particle of matter, that'll be such trouble, particle of antimatter, matter of antimatter. But the discovery of antimatter raises important questions for us humans. Because now we not only have to ask what's the matter, we have to ask what's the antimatter. And does it antimatter? But what's really kind of interesting is that the scientists are coming to the conclusion that consciousness plays a critical role in the creation of reality. The mystics have known this for centuries, but now the scientists are discovering it. They say that the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics says, and I quote, "There is no reality in the absence of observation." One physicist put it this way, when we're looking, there are particles. When we aren't looking, there are just waves, probability waves. So I'd like to conduct a little experiment here with you this evening. Please, everybody look over to this side of the room. Everybody look over to this side of the room. Okay, now that should mean the other side of the room has disappeared. Were you peeking? It's going to ruin the whole experiment. All right, let's look back. See, somebody probably was peeking, or else it reassembled itself or something. I don't know. Reality. What a concept. But what is becoming very clear is that there's really nothing here at all. E equals mc squared. At the very core of matter is energy. Everything is in flux. Everything is in process. There's no solidity. As one physicist put it, gravity, matter is just a gravitationally trapped light. It's all basically just a light show. As the Buddha said, "Thus shall you view the world, a star at dawn, a bubble in a stream, a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, a flickering lamp, a phantom, and a dream. So what's going to happen to this faux universe that we're all in? The scientists say everything is expanding outward in every direction very rapidly and will expand forever into nothingness. They call that a cold death. However, if there's enough gravity in the universe, perhaps enough gravitas, then maybe the expansion will slow down and everything will begin contracting in a process the scientists call the Big Crunch. Great name for a candy bar. And everything will collapse back again into a singularity. They call that a heat death. Which do you prefer? The universe is going to get you, coming or going. I like the idea that we all come back into a singularity again, and then maybe there'll be another Big Bang, and we'll all be reborn into another space-time universe, one with less friction, one with less troubles. The Dalai Lama was once asked if they had the Big Bang in Tibetan Buddhist cosmology. He said, but bang, 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 many bangs, many universes. The Hindus say their creator deity Brahma, every time he blinks his eyes shut, a universe is destroyed. Every time he opens his eyes again, another universe is created. You can try it for yourself, it actually works. But here we are, big banging away in this space-time universe. And we are, big banging away still. I mean, every time you move your hand, take a step, you are using that primal energy created by that explosion. Right now, inside your brain, millions of synapses are firing. We hope. That's the energy of the Big Bang trying to comprehend the Big Bang. We're pieces of the universe wondering about itself. And for now, anyway, at least on the surface, it seems, we're all doing this strange dance of matter. There's a dance everybody's doing, if they like it or not. Even when you're sleeping, you're doing it, you just can't stop. You may not know how to make the move, but every single part of you is in the groove. You're doing this subatomic shuffle. Your electrons are spinning around, they do it all night. Your left arms are leaping to the left and to the right. Your photons are flashing on and off, and all your antimatter is real gone stuff. All through that subatomic shuffle. Well, step inside the matter. You'll find a Mad Hatter. He'll pull you out on the floor. You'll be quivering your quarks while you're dancing in the dark. Your zipper strings will vibrate more and more. All doing that subatomic shuffle. Now listen. Everybody's dancing. Everybody's in step. The walls are dancing too. And the ceiling is hip. You may think there are things that are not alive, but look a little closer, it's a subatomic jive. Oh, it's a subatomic shuffle. And inside this dance, you can even find romance. Maybe get into an atom just for two. With your attraction is strong, you really get along. You'll find a charged particle coming at you. Want to do that subatomic shuffle with you? You know it's much better with you. The subatomic shuffle. understand. Don't say your mind keeps moving too after it falls out of your head. The scientists will tell you nothing dies. You can't stop dancing even if you try. Can't stop doing that seven times. Ultimate bebop. To be or not to bebop. It's the subatomic shuffle. So here we are, big banging away in this human life, this human form. And we try to make out that life is beautiful and serves some higher purpose. But I have my doubts. I've struggled my whole life with a kind of negative attitude. And I now consider myself a cynic in recovery. This is not to say that there aren't things to be cynical about. There are. Civilization. Humanity. But probably the biggest reason to have a somewhat negative attitude are the basic facts of life themselves. So as a kind of group therapy, let's just run through them here together. First of all, you didn't ask to be born. Or at least you don't remember asking. You know, sometime in early childhood, you kind of wake up, damn, I'm in a life. And everyone who's born is born with a very powerful survival instinct that makes you want more than anything else to stay alive. So you didn't ask to be born and you don't want to die. It's like nature trapped you in this life. You don't get to choose who you're going to be. You don't get to choose the body you will inhabit. I don't remember a catalog of choices being offered. Would you like eyes in the front and the back? Would you like to swim, fly, or walk as your primary means of locomotion? No choice. Vertebrate, biped, mid-sized mammal, big forebrain. That's it. You don't get to choose your personality. The geneticists say that we're all born with a particular temperament to be withdrawn or aggressive, novelty-seeking, reward-dependent. And the psychologists say whatever part of our personality isn't firmly set at birth will be in place long before we have any choice in the matter in early childhood. Which brings us to the fact that we don't get to choose our parents, but dear ones who will set our lifelong neurosis for us. And many of us feel like we got assigned to the wrong pair. So, we don't get to choose our personality, we don't get to choose our body, we're not free to be ourselves. We're forced to be ourselves. And then you've got to feed this body a few times a day. And that means you've got to work, type, think, schlep, or hunt, maybe. Every time you get out of bed in the morning, you fight gravity. With every step you take, you fight gravity. And you're not told why you're here or exactly what you're supposed to be doing while you're here. You're given just enough consciousness to know that you do exist and that someday you will die, which you very much don't want to do. These are the facts of life. As Wavy Gravy says, if you don't have a sense of humor, it's just not funny. I think Nietzsche put it well. He said, God's only excuse is that he doesn't exist. And then there's aging. I don't think I really understood aging until I started doing it more often. I didn't understand aging until my body began to explain it to me. First my eyes spoke up. Mr. Nisker, we've just about seen enough. Tired of gazing at beautiful women, beautiful sunsets, and you know, we're taking the receptors and the focusing muscles and going into semi-retirement. And then my bowels. They've been speaking to me my whole life, but they began to sing a different tune. All right, mister, we're tired of your crap. Tired of pushing it around down here. A couple shitloads a day. We're going on a work slowdown. And then my testicles, my dear testicles. Hey man, we produced a lot of sperm over the years down here, enough to populate an entire galaxy with your offspring. And we know you've wasted a lot of it too. Well, maybe you should seriously practice tantra or take robes or something, because we're running out of juice. And then my bladder. And my bladder tried to explain it nicely to me. Said, you know, Wes, you go over to the sink and you turn on the faucet and the washer's broke in there. You know, so then after that, the water comes out either sideways or in a spray. And then you can't turn it all the way off. Well, there's a washer broke down here. So don't expect to get a good night's sleep until your next life. And then my memory spoke up. They have two words for me. Forget it. Fucking forget it. No, I don't think I'm going to die anytime real soon. But now I know that no matter how well I take care of this body, gravity is going to win in its attempt to pull me back to Earth from whence I came. Oh, it's not a pretty picture. I read recently that as you age, your hard parts get softer and your soft parts get harder. It's like you kind of collapse around your organs. We also don't get to choose when we will live. The cultural moment that we will be alive in, which has a great influence on how we live our lives and how we feel about our lives. And here we are, big banging away, in the year 2008 AD. That's, of course, if you follow the Christian calendar. I don't think it's fair that we all should have to follow that calendar. I think there should be a separation of church and date. I mean, the Jews are in the year 5768. If we were following that calendar, we'd be having another decade of the 60s. You like that, don't you? We could go out in the desert, find a burning bush, and smoke it. But a calendar is just an arbitrary way of marking human history. Why don't we bring all humanity together under one calendar? We could start counting from the beginning of our species, say. That would make this about the year 1.5 million or so. It'd be a little hard to write on your checks, but it would give us more of a sense of where we're coming from. Of course, if we're all part of this Big Bang universe, then this is the year 13.7 billion ABB. However, if you're Hindu or Buddhist, with those universes after universes, you don't know what the hell time is. And I think that's why they invented the here and now. Just keep it simple. Here, now, that's it. So be here now. You missed it, I think. Just, you know, try to be alert. It'll come around again. Be here now. The news desk. Traffic report is over. You you are now listening to KNOW Radio, and this is Scoop Nister with another commentary on the way it is, the way it was, the way it will be. Friends, earthlings, baby boomers, members of the X, Y, and Z generations, all of you born in the last half century or so, lend me your pierced ears. I've come to praise your generations, not to bury them. That will happen later, and all too soon. One problem for recent generations is that the people who lived through the Great Depression and World War II now call themselves the greatest generation, and that leaves you with an impossible act to follow. And they accuse you of being spoiled, being slackers, having it too easy. But you can lay claims to your own Great Depressions and wars with enemies that are more personal, elusive, and existential. You were born into a time of transition, a time when the old stories are too old to have meaning and the new ones too new, a time when salvation keeps changing its brand name. You lived through so many revolutions, sexual, political, scientific, and technological, that your heads are now permanently spinning. As a result, those born in the last half century might collectively be called the confused generations. And there are very good reasons for your confusion. Consider that you grew up in a culture that is doubting its own mythology. Way back in 1966, Time magazine ran a cover story entitled, "Is God Dead?" And while the editors at Time chose not to answer the question, the fact that it was raised didn't bode well for the deity. That even if God isn't dead, he may be having a midlife crisis. Consider that recent generations grew up reading about the theory of relativity in school, and even though you still don't have a clue what it means, it entered your culture as the mantra, "It's all relative." So what is real and true and good is anybody's guess. And that led to the ethics of do your own thing, and to the recent ultimate one-word summation of relativity, whatever. Consider that you live all your lives with some kind of doom hanging over your heads, either nuclear winter or global warming. You lived through a time when technology in all of its forms, A-bombs, birth control pills, automobiles and airplanes, radios, movies, television and computers were driving and flying and seducing you far away from your homes toward a global village that has no center and no traditions. You grew up in a world of homelessness and uncertainty, and all the king's horses and all the president's men couldn't put it together again. Some of you who grew up in this time have since been wandering through the wreckage, trying to find some spiritual refuge, political sanity, or a mythology to fit the curve of your soul. The search led some of you to a faith in astrology, or Hindu elephant gods, or anarchist politics, or to a belief in rock and roll. So here's to your brave and adventuring spirit. This is Scoop Nister on KNOW Radio, reminding you to keep questioning authority and questioning reality. And if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. Yes. A strange time we live in. But if we look back at history, we've got to admit, all of us who've lived through the last 50 or more, 75 or more years here in the United States, here in the overdeveloped world, we have been living in a golden age. We have been enjoying an unprecedented time of freedom and abundance. You have been enjoying it, haven't you? Of course, we've learned that desire is endless. If there's any one thing our civilization has taught us, it's that desire is endless. And satisfaction in life is always geared to expectation. And some of us were brought up with great expectations. Some of us were brought up being told you can have it all. Some of us were brought up being told you can be anyone you want to be. You can own anything you want to own. You can go anywhere you want to go. You can eat anything you want to eat. That's right. You can be anyone you want to be. Be the president of the USA. Or be bent any which way. You can be a fool, be a somebody or nobody home, a contender or a pretender to the throne, be a drone or the queen bee. Be a buyer, a seller, a singer, or a teller of tales, or a lifter of bales. Be a banker, a golfer, a wanker, a rolfer, a CEO, a CPA, an SOB, an MFA, or really go far, be a rock and roll star. And maybe you could even be a deity. Be a god, by God. Then you can be everyone you want to be simultaneously. Because you can be, you can own, you can own. You can own anything you want to own. Own a house, own a tree, maybe 20 TVs, get a piece of the rock. Why not own a whole block? You could even own a wilderness, and I guess a mountain could be yours, or a lake, or an island. You could even own a country of your own, call it my land. Own a thousand pair of shoes, and a cure for the blues, the bills, the thrills. Don't worry about the bills, you got credit card checks, you could even pay in dollars. If there's anything you want, just holler. Own a classic piece of art, the original rendition, the first edition of your favorite creation. Maybe you could even buy yourself a revelation. Or buy yourself a new start. A new part. A new nose, a new chin, a new heart, a new do, a new you. Because you can be, you can own, you can eat. You can eat. You are the main man, top of the food chain, man. You can eat high on the hog, eat the legs of the frog, the brains or the stomach or the toes of any creature that you meet. And if you don't like their color, you can dye them before you fry them. And if you don't like their texture, you can get them tenderized before you bite into their thighs. Some fauna, flora, come on, have some more of them. Have some foul fish, have another dish. Don't forget the cow, and how would you like that prepared in a steak or a burger or a stew or moo? You are the main man, an American man. You can eat any cuisine on the planet in scene. Japanese, Japanese, Indian, Armenian, fast food, hot food, raw food, you got food to eat. And then don't. You can go from the nation just to visit any nation. Take a notion, get in motion, and just go. Do the mountains, or the prairies, or the oceans, wipe the foam, leave home. Now you can go to Walla Walla, but I don't know why you want to. When you could go to Oaxaca, or get a nice palapa in Hawaii, or Fiji. Why not go to Fiji and go diving in the reefs, or roll yourself asleep in Jamaica, or take a nice safari to Nairobi or the Gobies. Or go up the Himalayas to Shambhala. Or up the Alps to Valhalla. Or go visit the Maori or go look at Purgatory in Japan, man. Oh, but if you really, truly want it, you can travel to your mind. That's right. And escape the desires of this crazy creation. Get off the wheel of birth and death and reincarnation. Get off the wheel that keeps you always being and owning and eating and going and being and owning and get off the wheel. Get off the wheel. Get off the wheel.
Buddhists like that one. Huh? I'm usually in bed by now, you know. Yeah, some of us, you know, we grew up having so much to desire that what we ended up wanting more than anything else was the end of desire. Like many people in my generation, I've spent a lot of time and energy in my life searching for my true identity. Like, it's here somewhere. Yeah. I've also been looking for the root of this lifelong sense of alienation. I mean, just being born in this era is enough. But we all have our own stories to add to the mix. I think my alienation can be traced back, at least in part, to the fact that I was born and raised the only Jewish kid in a small town in Nebraska. My whole spiritual path started out kind of flat. In order to teach me my bar mitzvah lessons, my parents had to hire a circuit rabbi. Came through town every 2 weeks on the Greyhound bus. His name was Rabbi Falik. F-A-L-I-K. Which is probably one reason he didn't have his own congregation. But Rabbi Falik was teaching me this transliterated Hebrew script that I didn't understand at all, in order to go through a ritual to join a community that in my hometown didn't exist. It was a bit confusing. I kept the faith, mostly. I sang in the junior high choir, and every year we had a Christmas program and sang carols. But whenever the songs came to the words, Christ our Savior or Jesus Lord, I would secretly cross my fingers. I didn't want God to think I had fallen for this hoax. I did have a spiritual teacher growing up, Alfred E. Newman, the great American teenage tantric master, the grinning guru, and I studied the works of Alfred E. Newman very carefully. No matter what kind of cartoon apocalypse was going on, all he ever did was grin and say, "What me worry?" Which is a very succinct statement of realization, actually. Unfortunately, at the time, I didn't realize it was a rhetorical question. Every time I asked, "What me worry?" I answered back, "Yes, me worry." I went to college and majored in philosophy, trying to find some answers to this life I'm leading. I slogged through all the great Western thinkers, Plato, Aristotle, St. Augustine, Kant, Leibniz, Descartes. You know, we all know what Descartes said. What he should have said was, "I think, therefore I think I am." Because that's all these guys ever did was think. All this brain-twisting, brow-bending effort to figure everything out. Finally, when I was a senior, I got to take a seminar in the existentialist, who told me that all previous Western philosophy was bunk and nonsense. Only I could have taken that seminar when I was a freshman. Saved myself 3 years of heavy thinking. Because the existentialist said the universe and life are absurd. And that sounded right to me. And at least they said from our level of consciousness, we humans can't figure out what's going on here. And that was a relief for me to hear that, because I thought I was the only one who didn't get it, you know? So I loved the existentialists. I read all their books. Nausea, No Exit, The Concept of Dread, that was a good one, Fear and Loathing, and The Sickness Unto Death. I had found my community. The philosophically depressed. Because the existentialists were not happy. What they wanted most was to get out of their mind, out of the thinking game. What they wanted most was just to be. Camus wrote, "If only I were a cat among cats or a tree among trees, I would be at one with the world. It is this insistence on meaning and reason that sets me apart from all things." And Sartre, summing up the existential position and all previous Western philosophy, said simply, "Being has not been given its due." Now, lucky for me, as I was coming of age, the Asian wisdom traditions were being popularized in the West by hip scholars like Alan Watts, who informed me that for centuries, the Hindus and Taoists and Buddhists had also emphasized non-thinking and just being, and had even developed exercises that could teach you how to just be. I thought, that is so cool. What would it be like to just be? I thought maybe I should go to Asia and take being lessons, you know? And at the same time, I was reading the beatniks, who were telling me to get in the groove, to go with the flow, to get with it. Get with it. Present for every moment in the great rift of life. And for someone like myself, who had always felt like an outsider, reading the beatniks was very exciting, dangerous, I'll never forget first reading Allen Ginsberg's poem, Howl, written in 1956, in which he denounces the god of war and commerce, that even men had begun taking over the soul of this nation. He named that god Moloch. Moloch, the loveless. Mental Moloch. Moloch whose mind is pure machinery. Moloch whose blood is running money. Moloch whose fingers are 10 armies. Moloch whose breast is a cannibal dynamo. Moloch whose ears are smoking tombs. But the beatniks were really mystics and romantics at heart. As Ginsberg said, they were beatifically beat. And they began introducing these exotic words into the hipster's lexicon. Words like dharma and karma and mantra and tantra. Om Shanti. So exciting. I finally decided to move to San Francisco to be a beatnik. 1967. Too late to make the scene. But I got assigned to the hippies instead. And I'm proud to say I was a hippie. Can I get a witness? Yeah. There must be many. We were groovy. We were optimistic, idealistic, psychedelic. We were flower children. And we actually dragged Bohemia out of the dark bars and coffee houses for a few brief years of colorful frolicking in the sun, celebrating the age of Aquarius. It was wonderful. The hippies weren't very political. They went to anti-war marches and stuff, but we had no 5-year plan. We basically wanted a world of peace, love, and good vibes. Is that too much to ask? Apparently. The hippies started holding be-ins, communal celebrations of just being. The existentialists would have loved us. This is the San Francisco Oracle in 1967 announcing the first human be-in in Golden Gate Park. The spiritual revolution will be manifest and proven. We will shower the nation with waves of ecstasy and purification. Fear will be washed away, ignorance exposed to sunlight. Prophets and empire will lie drying on deserted beaches. A spiritual revolution. How wonderfully naive we were. And how sweet. And 1968, I got a job doing news at a counterculture hippie radio station in San Francisco, KSAN Jive 95. Yeah. A radio station unimaginable today. Every morning, live on the air, the disc jockey threw the E-chain. Quite often, throughout the day, you would hear the unmistakable sound. How's your head, man? Yeah. One story that I covered that I think kind of captures that time, the flavor of that time. July 20th, 1969. Americans land on the moon. A hippie in San Francisco takes LSD, jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge, survives with very little injury. I went to interview him in his hospital room, and he said he jumped off the bridge for spiritual advancement. So I combined his voice with that of Neil Armstrong as one giant leap for mankind. We were the counterculture. And we were carrying out experiments in consciousness. And we did help launch the modern environmental movement and the New Age spiritual revival, help shorten the war in Vietnam. For all those reasons, I think somewhere, maybe on the Mall in Washington, D.C., there should be a statue to the unknown hippie. People could leave buttons and joints and even though I was a hippie having a good time, I still was plagued with doubts. I was still basically dissatisfied, and I started exploring the New Age spiritual movement that was burgeoning in the Bay Area in the late 60s, early 70s. I tried a lot of stuff, a lot of workshops and seminars and intensives and a lot of body work. I got the soles of my feet, the crystals broken up in the soles of my feet a couple times. I got Rolf. That's where they tear your muscles off your bones and put them where they're supposed to be. I had my shoulders lowered. They used to be way up here. I remember going to one seminar. I was hooked up to a biofeedback machine. I was supposed to watch this monitor and try to balance the waves coming off the left and right hemisphere of my brain. We didn't know what we were doing, you know. We were experimenting. I tried a lot of New Age products. Oh, yeah. I mean, the spirit of commerce could not ignore the commerce in spirit. So I had for quite a while, maybe a couple of years, I had a negative ion generator in my bedroom. I don't know. I mean, maybe if it hadn't been there, I'd be dead by now. For a while, I did the spirulina diet, you know, doing the blue-green algae. You know. It got me addressing my inner fish, you know. For a while, I wore nothing but negative heel shoes. It's supposed to be good for your spine, but it always left me feeling a little detached from it. Oh, what we haven't fallen for in our search for perfection. At some point, I started going to a weekly Buddhist meditation group. And things, yeah, that's when things started to change for me. It's supposed to be quiet. And, you didn't meditate today, you had to have it, did you? But this group started changing my attitude some. I stopped worrying quite so much about this life. But I started worrying about my next life. Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? You know, it's always something. Finally, 1970, I went to India along with a great wave of young Westerners in what turned out to be a pilgrimage of historic proportions. We were going to study these ancient wisdom traditions at the source. We were going to try to find a way to get high and never have to come down. I thought I'd go and meet a guru and teach me how to merge with the cosmic oneness. You know, and then my painful self-consciousness would disappear. The bliss would kick in. I thought it would take a couple months. Who knew? This idea of merging with the cosmic oneness was quite popular back in the 60s, probably because of the drugs. I remember often standing around in a stone conversation with people, and almost invariably, someone would say, "Yeah, man, yeah, everything is everything." That was a conversation stopper for sure. No further distinctions can be made. But of course, it's true. Everything is everything. And vice versa. My first meditation retreat took place in Bodh Gaya, India, just a few blocks from where the Buddha was enlightened. That was so romantic. And my first teacher was a jolly, rotund Indian man who used to sing Buddhist chants to us every morning and evening in a deep baritone. Hare Javata Sankara Upadavaya Damino. It is the nature of all things to arise and pass away. Happy are those who can live deeply with this truth. That first meditation retreat was the most shocking experience of my life. I had a degree from a good American university. I'd done some therapy and New Age groups and stuff, but nobody in my culture had told me you can actually develop this part of your mind, this
mindfulness, and you can actually step outside of your own psyche, outside of your own drama, and observe yourself. And that first look was pretty disturbing. The instructions were simple. Just pay attention to your breath coming in, going out. Started to do that. Realized that my mind continued to think and plan and have fantasies and regrets and talk and without even consulting me. I began to realize my mind had a mind of its own. And it had a thinking problem. My mind was a heavy thinker. I started thinking the minute I got up in the morning, think in the middle of the afternoon, had to have a couple of thoughts before I went to bed. I needed an intervention. What was even more disturbing is that while I was meditating, my mind kept singing to me. And not New Age meditation music, but pop songs with good hooks, you know? Rolling on a river. We all live in Dolphin. It was the deep imprinting, if you know what I mean. But it was insidious. I couldn't turn them off. These songs would randomly pop into my head and go on and on, repeat. Sometimes a song would pop into my head that was on an album side that I was familiar with. My mind would track through the album. Sometimes flip it over, play it the other side. Other Westerners I've talked to have had this experience, similar experiences. I call it jukebox karma. Like many others who I've talked to, when I first started meditating, I thought I could give myself a new personality. I thought I could actually become someone totally different. Someone who would be easier to live with. But after 35 years of doing this practice, I'm basically the same person I was when I started. However, I no longer take my personality quite so personally. I now view it kind of like a pet. You know, I live with it, I take care of it, sometimes I let it off the leash. But my primary identity has shifted a little. Now I see that these thoughts and emotions are just moving through me. This personality is living through me. Even this breath and this heartbeat are going on without my willing. Life is living through me. As George Harrison wrote, it all goes on within you and without you. So I've learned to step outside of my drama a little bit. And what a relief it is to learn how to ignore yourself. And as the sages say, the more you begin to let go of the self, the more you begin to gain the world. And the more your heart begins to open to the world, and that's really the greatest gift of all. I think the whole process can be summed up best by the 20th century sage Nisargadatta Maharaj, who said simply, "Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. In between the two, my life flows." When I was in India studying Buddhism, I couldn't help but notice that a disproportionate number of the people over there doing this practice were Jewish. And then I came back to the United States, and the first big Western meditation center was started by Goldstein, Cornfield, Salzburg, and Schwartz. Sounds more like a law firm than a Buddhist college. So a lot of people have wondered about this phenomenon, you know, and I think it's because opposites attract. So you take the detachment and quietude of the Buddhist, and you put it together with Jewish chutzpah and verbosity, you kind of have a full-spectrum emotional approach to life. I think there could be a whole new ethnic group forming. The Buddhist people. And our sacred mantra, Om Shalom. Peace, 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 peace. Of course, in the Buddhist religion, the wisdom would be transmitted primarily through the use of knock-knock jokes. You laugh. But the disciple comes to the master and says, and the master answers with the number one spiritual question, who's there? If you don't get the joke, you have to be reborn over and over again. So be here now. Almost. You were just right on top of it. Now, this is an unusual thing to ask of a group that's come to a show, but I would like you to close your eyes and just bring your attention inward. I'm not going to play any jokes on you or anything, or the pickpockets will come around. So just close your eyes and bring your attention inward. Feel your breath coming in and going out. The breath is a sign of life. Proof that you're one of the live ones. Don't think now. Don't think. Where'd that thought come from? For a couple moments, just be aware that you are aware. That you have this strange ability to know yourself and the world. This is a rare experience, at least in our corner of the Milky Way, it seems.
Okay. You can open your eyes. It's time for the news. You should meditate before and after every newscast. Hello, humans, and if you can understand what I'm saying, that's probably what you are. Welcome to another K-Now News Commentary. This is Scoop here to remind you that the Earth is spinning around on its axis at 1,000 miles an hour, causing the creatures who live on the surface to grow dizzy and bump into each other, making news. And here's an update on life in the food chain and who's eating whom. And I think we are all aware that life on Earth is now going through a difficult period, and a lot of the trouble has to do with the activity of our species. We have discovered a problem, and it is us. Maybe we just got too smart for our own good. Maybe our tool-making ability got too far ahead of our ability to control our own hearts and minds. As evidence, consider the nuclear arms race. Boy, was that a dumb idea. At one point, the United States and Soviet Union each had enough explosives to blow up the whole planet 10 times over. They even made up a new word to describe it, overkill. So what were the generals thinking? That we could be dead again, Christians? And dead again, communists? The only consolation might be that the second time they kill you, it doesn't hurt so much because you're already dead. The reasoning behind overkill was a Cold War strategy known as mutual assured destruction, or MAD, which says that each side has to be able to blow up the other side an equal number of times, and then neither side will try it. Now, however, the Pentagon is developing smaller nuclear weapons that they believe can be used without triggering a full-scale nuclear war, leading to a new official doctrine named the Nuclear Utilization Targeting Strategy, or NUTS. The Pentagon went from mad to nuts. Another sign of trouble, humans, is that the Earth's climate is heating up, and most scientists who don't work for the oil companies say it's at least partially due to human pollution. In short, we are starting to cook ourselves. The only question that remains may be the cooking method we use. If we trap enough greenhouse gases, we will be poached. But if we destroy the ozone layer first, we will be microwaved. Would you like fries with that? Another sign of trouble on Earth is the fact that species of life are dying off in record numbers. According to biologists, we are now living through the third or fourth largest extinction extinction spasm in biological history. Clearly, the major cause is the burgeoning human herds trampling across the planet, consuming everything in their path. The tragic results can be found on the endangered species list, which in the future may be used as an indictment of all of us for crimes against non-humanity. The endangered list is full of our favorite animals. All the stars of the TV nature shows are on the list. Elephants, rhinos, jaguars, and gorillas. The animals of our mythologies and poetry are facing extinction. The turtle that holds the earth on its back. The fox goes out on the town, oh, town, oh. The lions and tigers and bears, oh, my. We are losing the frogs, Kermit, and the birds, Big Bird. There's been an estimated 75% decline in the population of songbirds in North America and a corresponding 75% decline in bird songs. Maybe the endangered species list should be read aloud in churches and schools. Every time a new species makes the list, we should put its picture on milk cartons like a missing child. Otherwise, how will we know? That's the news for now, humans. Our ancestors did what needed to be done, and we survived ice ages, comet collisions, plagues, Attila the Hun, even Henry Kissinger. So there's reason for optimism. And this is Scoop for KNOW News, saying, if you don't like it, go out and make some of your own.
What can we do? What can be done? Well, one thing is becoming perfectly clear. There are just too many of us. Some of you will have to go. I think the people who wrote the Bible got God's message wrong. It wasn't go forth and multiply. It was go forth and add. I just saw a bumper sticker that read, 6 billion people can't be right. One thing that we must do, those of us here in the overdeveloped world, is chill. Relax. Not do so much. Not consume so much. Just be for a while. We're going to have to change our ways. Remember back in the 70s there was a movement called voluntary simplicity? Not enough people volunteered. So now we're going to have compulsory simplicity. You could call it the decline and fall. It's going to happen. It's no shame. You know, it happens throughout history. Look back, you see empires like ours rising and falling at regular intervals. Mesopotamia, Babylonia, Egypt, the Mayans, Aztecs, Greeks, Romans, all once great civilizations, and great empires, now just ruins that tourists climb around on and take pictures of. More recently, we have the European empires, Britain and France and Spain and Portugal. Just a few decades ago, the Brits were proud to say the sun never sets on the British Empire. Now it's just those chilly little islands in the North Atlantic. The sun never even rises on the British Empire. The United States inherited the European colonies, took them over with Coca-Cola and television and dreams too rich to ever be fulfilled, and now there's no question, we rule. But even now, at the height of our power, we are beginning to see the classic signs of decline. This is Edward Gibbon from his famous book, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. The cause of Rome's decline lie in her bloated and overextended military, her widespread economic and political corruption, her public apathy and hedonism, her addiction to and dependence on foreign resources. Does it sound familiar? That's because it happens the same way every time. Every time. So where are we on our timeline of decline? I think we are experiencing our era of crazy Caesars. Nixon, Reagan, the Bushes, Clinton's a little Caligula thrown in there. But take George W. Caesar. You know, I mean, he's a classic crazy emperor. Pouty, arrogant, a bit of a buffoon. He's like Nero. You know, the atmosphere is on fire, and he's out fiddling with his chainsaw clearing the brush. I have an image of George W. looking up at the sun,
and saying, bring it on.
A couple years ago, in the midst of his failed wars, he announced that he wanted the United States to go to Mars. And in making the announcement, he said, and I quote, "It's time for humans to head for the solar system." What planet is he living on? But it's a typical imperial folly, you know? I mean, the end of the fossil fuel era, all your leaders are in the oil business. And you don't send a big standing army out to fight guerrilla wars. I mean, ask Alexander the Great, or King George of England, or Lyndon Johnson. As George Bernard Shaw once said, we learn from history that we learn nothing from history. The problem in the past has been that all the great empires have greedily hung on to their power and prosperity, causing great suffering for people in the colonies and in the mother country. What if we could see the writing on the wall and do this whole decline and fall thing with more ease and grace and consciousness? I have a plan. Very simple. Kind of channeled itself through me. We simply go to the United Nations and announce to the world that we would like to resign as a superpower. We see what's happening. From now on, we'd like to be known as just an ordinary nation. The whole world would applaud. It would be great for us. We could relax. We wouldn't have to work so hard keeping a superpower economy going. You know, we wouldn't necessarily be the prime target of terrorists anymore. We could let down some of our defenses. We wouldn't have to spend $500 billion a year on our military, which, by the way, is more than all the other military budgets in the world combined. You know, there's really nothing to fear about losing our superpower status. Remember, Rome also didn't decline in a day. And while it was declining, a lot of Roman citizens probably didn't even notice it was happening. And a few centuries later, they started calling themselves Italians. They're doing fine today. Besides, ours would be the world's first intentional decline. So to help us ease our transition, the government could start some public works projects like the Roosevelt New Deal. Only this would be the New Age New Deal. I envision a 5-year plan called the Great Leap Backward. So the government would start a department of meditation and therapy, which would set up deprogramming centers around the country and teach hyperactive American workers how to be less productive members of a less productive society. The government could pay people by the hour to work on themselves. We could all work with the mantra, enough. Enough. We've got enough stuff. Enough. Yeah, it works. Construction workers could be put back to work on disassembly lines. Take apart the cars, separate the steel back into ores, and shovel it all into the ground again. The Army Corps of Engineers, take apart the dams, let the rivers run free, under the slogan, making the world safe for nature. Forget about democracy, nature. Maybe we could ask Egypt, Mexico, India, start a reverse Peace Corps. Send us volunteers to teach us how to live more simply. Teach us how to cook tasty meals of rice and beans. How to wash our clothes on rocks. And most important, when and how to take the siesta. And as we make our transition, in order to keep our currency afloat, what we do better than anybody else on this planet is entertain. The whole world loves U.S. entertainment. So as we announce that we are resigning as a superpower, we simultaneously invite the rest of the world to come and witness this historic moment, the world's first intentional decline and fall. We open up the entire country. The entire country as one vast theme park called Formerly Great America. The downhill ride would be spectacular. Woo!
Deep Seattle, 1855, writing to the Great White Father in Washington. Tribe follows tribe and nation follows nation like the waves of the sea. It is the order of nations, and regret is useless. Your time of decay may be distant, but it will surely come. For even the white man whose God walked and talked with him as friend with friend cannot be exempt from the common destiny. We may be brothers after all. We will see. During a decline and fall, you often run into some God problems. Just think, the descendants of a family living near the Mediterranean could have gone from believing in Kronos to believing in Zeus to believing in Jupiter to believing in Jehovah and then adding Jesus in just the last 5 millennia. Even among the gods, there is occasional regime change. I got caught in the changeover. I remember going to synagogue and trembling, praying to Jehovah to write me into a book of life for another year. I even had an image of this God. He was Italian. You know, the guy up there on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. The Jews said we weren't supposed to make a graven image. Saved us a lot of money on statues. But then the Italians inherited Jehovah and couldn't resist trying to paint him. Now, I don't go to synagogue so much anymore. I now have a private altar at home. On my altar is a statue of the dignified meditating Buddha, a little Chinese laughing Buddha, wooden head, a picture of the goddess Kali, a little figurine of the native trickster Coyote. Other deities get shuffled onto my altar from time to time. I'm a spiritual slut. I sometimes think I'm just in recovery from monotheism. Sometimes I look at this altar of deities, I think, none of them have a green card, you know? They've all been smuggled into this country by people like myself. And now I have a kind of New Age belief that all of the gods and all of the goddesses and the rituals and the symbols, they all point to the same mystery. And I have great reverence for that mystery and whoever or whatever created it, who I now refer to as the artist, formerly known as God. But maybe we need a whole new story. I think we really need an upgrade of our mythology. Our major religions now regard the Earth as little more than a training planet. You know, a place where you come to learn some lessons or burn off some karma, and then you get to go off to some place where you truly belong. Those beliefs are now dysfunctional. What if we could embrace ourselves as part of the life of this planet? What if we could embrace our identity as Earthlings? We are made of all natural earth ingredients. Your bones are made of calcium, magnesium, phosphates, silicates. Basically, the clay of earth molded into your shape. Most of our bodies are liquid, and most of that liquid has the chemical consistency of the oceans. We sweat and cry seawater. We're not just on the earth. We're of the earth. We're like earth sprouts that gain a lot of mobility, you know? We're earth walking on earth, sitting on earth. I'm composed of all the life that came before me. Right now, inside your skull is a fully functioning reptilian brain, a fully functioning mammalian brain, and the new human brain, neocortex. And there's serious speculation among scientists that we used our new human brain mostly to make excuses for the behavior generated by the other people. We're not so much rational animals as we are rationalizing animals. But if we can see ourselves in the story of evolution, we're immediately forgiven for everything. Because we see that we're just a baby species. There were 100 million generations of dinosaurs, 10 million generations of mammals before humans came along. We've had maybe 10, 20,000 generations of Homo sapiens sapiens.
We just got these big brains and don't know how to use them very well yet. They didn't come with a good instruction manual. So it's clear, humans should not be tried as adults. We are forgiven. If we see ourselves in the story of evolution, our family increases a million-fold because we realize that we are related to everything that's ever lived, related to the miracle molecule of DNA composed of four chemical compounds, and depending on how they're arranged in these long strings of coded information, a DNA molecule will contribute to the growth of an ant or a sequoia or a rose or a human being. It's a miracle substance. It separates life from non-life. Deoxyribonucleic acid? Much too cold and clinical a name for this magic substance. So I declare a new acronym here tonight. From now on, every time you see or hear the letters DNA, think divine natural abundance. The seed of all life. And as you may know, almost 100% of your DNA is identical to the DNA of the person sitting next to you. The instructions for building and maintaining you are almost exactly the same as the instructions for building and maintaining George Bush. Or the Dalai Lama. Or Mother Teresa. Or Paris Hilton. The IQ and personality are just a thin coat of paint over the basic human design. We share over 98% of our DNA with chimpanzees, over 90% with mice, over 70% with worms, almost 50% with yeast. So if you declare yourself divine, is not the slime also divine? And if not, where do we draw the line? Who gets a soul? There's a t-shirt put out by the biology department at UC Santa Cruz. It says, you share 25% of your DNA with bananas, get over yourself. Evolution is a great source of self-liberation. The fact is that, you know, a case could be made, a good case, that the entire universe was made for bacteria. They are the most successful species. They survived a couple billion years, and they are everywhere. There are more individual living bacteria in your mouth right now than all the humans that have ever lived on planet Earth. They've got churches and roads and whole civilization between your cheeks. There's some speculation that the bacteria invented humans as a moving feedlot. You know, get room and board and a tour of the neighborhood. Of course, the secret of their success is that they reproduce by just dividing. They don't have to take each other out to dinner first. The bacteria, they're related to us. But now we are a brand new kind of animal. I hope you aren't offended by being called an animal. That is how our eminent scientists classify us. I know a lot of you are in denial. You know, you go to a supermarket or a cafe and there's a sign in the window, no animals allowed. Humans walk right in. No animals here. But we are brand new. Our ancestors just came down from the trees about 5 million years ago. Among them was an ape woman named Lucy, who the scientists now say was the mother of us all. So we can presume the father of us all was Ricky. We started hanging out on the ground and using crude stone tools. And eventually became what we now call Homo habilis, or handyman. And handyman started standing upright more often, probably to fix a leaky roof. And before long, we became what we now call Homo erectus, or upright human. And we're not talking morality here. Actually, standing upright was the first instance of full frontal nudity. And so, soon after we stood up, in all probability, the loincloth was invented. But standing up was a very important moment in evolution because it's associated with a rapid increase in brain size. Now, you would think that standing up would make our feet swell. But here's the theory. Standing up left our hands free to work with tools, axes and spears and chopsticks. And we needed more brain connections to work the more precise movements of our hands and fingers. So this feedback loop was created. Bigger hands, bigger brains. And standing up left our arms free to carry our stuff around. So eventually we started migrating out of Africa. Nobody knows exactly why we left. I suspect it was to look for Chinese food. Yeah, I mean, at the time, our brains were half the size they are today. You know, or else we would have figured out how to send out for Chinese food. And we started wandering around the planet. Our brains kept growing. They kept getting bigger. Probably because we got caught in an ice age or two, had to think hard and fast how to stay warm. Could have just grown maybe a heavy coat of fur, but we didn't think of it at the time because our brains were too small. So we grew bigger brains and learned how to make fire and began sitting around that fire and telling stories about ourselves like this one, about evolution. Somewhere back in there, our brains got so big, they outgrew our skull. And we had to get a brand new skull, rounded and dome-shaped here in front. Probably none of you are old enough to remember the old slope-head model skull. You might have some relatives who still have that. But now we're creeping up on ourselves here. We're creeping up. We're getting close to ourselves here. 40,000 years ago, the Cro-Magnon people appeared. They began holding elaborate burial rituals and making masks and jewelry, obviously having begun asking the really big questions like, who are we? Where do we come from? Having become what we now think of as Homo sapiens, sapiens are twice knowing humans, they're twice wise. We know that we know now. Or else we have to hear something at least twice before we know. The Cro-Magnon people, I think, were the first to display a sense of humor, which they probably got by watching Neanderthals work with tools. You know, there's always dropping them, and you know, they just didn't have it together. Okay, 10,000 years ago, our really big human brain starts kicking in really strong, and our really great grandparents begin making agriculture, living in cities. The last 10,000 years has been a complete revolution in the life of this planet due to the activity of our species. Now we can fly off the planet, out into space, we can see to the edges of the universe, and deep inside of matter, we know how everything in nature works to some degree. In the last 200 years, we've nearly doubled the average human lifespan. Just a couple generations ago, most of our ancestors were peasants, and now most of us are called on to absorb many volumes of information in a lifetime and operate fairly sophisticated machinery. It's a whole new world out there. And considering that, I think we're doing a pretty good job of being humans. Kudos to all of us. I mean, the evolutionary scientists say we're still working with brains designed primarily for members of small tribes of hunter-gatherers. That explains our addiction to shopping. You know? If it's out there, go get it. But if we see ourselves in evolution, in this story, we also find hope because we realize that we're now entering a whole new phase of our existence. Just 2,500 years ago, blink of an eye in biological time, we had Socrates, the Buddha, Lao Tzu, a whole new kind of consciousness. Basically, our contemporaries, Darwin, Freud, Jung, Einstein, Hubble, we're just now getting a whole new picture of who we are in the scheme of things. And the more we learn about ourselves and the life of this planet, the more wondrous the story becomes. We now know that life has gone from a single-celled being to a being with 100 trillion cells. you and me. And inside each of your 100 trillion cells is a little being that is transforming the sun's energy into your living energy moment after moment. And you hardly have to lift a finger. Right now your brain is processing approximately 11 million bits of information a second, and you hardly have to lift a finger. As the Sufi poet Hafiz says, "O wondrous creatures, by what strange miracle do you so often not smile?" Sometimes when I get discouraged, I think, well, it's taken the universe 13.7 billion years to make me. Now that should be cause for some self-esteem. What a project! 13.7 billion years, so it hasn't made you perfect yet. There's time, and there's hope. So, I ask you, please, do what you can. Do what needs to be done. And while you're doing it, be sure to keep a couple of big perspectives handy, ready to be unfurled in your mind at a moment's notice. It'll keep you relaxed and motivated. Try to remember that everything is everything. And vice versa. Everything is everything, for better or for worse. Everything is everything on some level anyway. Everything is just a play of shadow and light. Everything is everything morning, noon, and night. Plato said, "We live in a cave of illusion." And the Taoist wonders, "Am I awake or in a dream?" And Einstein came to this conclusion. He said, "This matter is not what it seems." And everything is poetry and physics, say the scientists and the mystics. It's in space-time. It's all in your mind. It's what you believe. It's the dance of Shiva, the veil of Maya, the net of Indra. That's the robes of the prophet. It's all made out of the same cloth. It's electrical, chemical, AC and DC, and E equals MC squared. And that means MC squared equals E. It's quarks, leptons, gluons, neons, and muons for eons and eons. Through a telescope or a microscope, it's all the same by any name. The macro, the micro, the sky above, the mud below. It's all one. And there's really nothing new under the sun. Everything is sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Everything is the United American Amalgamated Corporation Incorporated. Everything is a metaphor for everything else. Everything is you. You are the universe. You are part of it all. And I take from that if you don't like the news, you should go out and make some of your own. Thank you very much.